This week on the line, we've got Leah Cohen in the studio.
Leah has so much to talk about. Welcome to On the Line. Hi. Today we have my dear friend, wonderful chef, mom, and Dan's going to tell us a little more about our amazing Leah Cohen.
I have a pre-prepared statement.
Okay.
I'm clapping.
Yay!
I'm clapping. Everybody clap with me. Just kidding.
Leah, so first of all, whoever told me to put my phone on airplane mode, but then told me to sign into Wi-Fi, airplane mode, you still get phone calls, which is, that doesn't work. Just so you know.
That's going reference. On the cutting room floor right there.
No, it's absolutely not. My mom is calling. All right, hold on.
Hi, Mom.
I'm going to tell a little bit later. I remember the moment that I met you, you make such a lasting and indelible impression. The moment, it was such a fun, what a fun time. So I, Daniel Holzman, am very excited to introduce our next guest, Leah Cohen. Leah is a person who I've known, Leah is a person who I've had the very great pleasure of enjoying her food and friendship for many, many years. A restaurant neighbor and colleague, a fellow New Yorker, boogie down Bronx. Recent Jersey refugee and someone who's helping shape the future of food in America by introducing the wonders of Southeast Asian cuisine.
Yeah, yeah.
Leah found her passion for food early in life and never looked back. Throughout her career, she's been recognized for her raw talent, and her resume as a cook is one that any aspiring chef would envy, working through some of the finest restaurants in Europe and the United States. Leah's career took a turn for the even better when she was asked to compete on season 5 of Bravo's Top Chef, most famous culinary, blah, 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 you're amazing.
The most famous season, too.
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah. That's what I think.
Real? Yeah, there was a lot of famous people who've become famous from that. Yeah.
Leah's time on the big screen helped her recognize and redefine her love for Southeast Asian cuisine and gave her the confidence to pursue her passion, which ultimately led her to opening Pig and Cow in New York City's Lower East Side. Pig and Cow was an immediate success and remains an institution and testament to Leah's love affair with food. Oh no, Jesus.
What happened?
Ah, oh, you're fucked up. Oh, I'm so upset.
What happened?
Oh, it's the old script. And I called you the...
nickname for me?
I did. I called you the queen of Southeast Asian cuisine. It was an alliteration. No wonder it didn't go. So,
wait,
Leah Cohen. No, I'm not doing it over again. This is the beauty of the world.
Wouldn't that call her that nickname?
I just did. The queen of Southeast Asian cuisine. I think it's great. I learned something about you reading your bio recently. Are you part Romanian?
Russian, Romanian, Jew.
Russian, yes. Romanian, Jew.
Yes.
I feel like there's depression in your past.
I think there's depression right now.
I'm not depressed.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm actually a very happy person. So, my husband, on the other hand.
Well, we can talk about Ben later.
You have a husband that's you have a restaurateur husband, and not only is he a restaurateur, he's a partner.
Yes. Scandal. He was my sous chef when we first started dating, and then he... You know.
Hashtag him too.
Yeah, he scored the boss.
Listen, I feel like this is something we should talk about. Not with just Leah, no. But like we talk about dating at work.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, there's nowhere who else are you gonna find, right? And no one else is gonna understand your life, your schedule. So
There he was.
And
well, I happen to be a big fan of Ben.
I know.
I love Ben. He is hilarious, dry, negative, positive,
a great dad.
Dan, you would love him.
I know Ben. So when I first met you, there was a failed food event that happened in Brooklyn. Remember in Brooklyn, Ugamuga. The great Ugamuga. Do you remember that? It got rained out and we all lost thousands of dollars.
Oh, yes.
That was the second year.
Yeah. It was you and there was, you were one of the chefs there. It was Jamie Bissonette was there. Yeah. Dale Talde was there. Yeah.
Jamie from Boston, Dale from
New York.
And
New York.
Everybody had like 10,000 portions worth of food. And then it rained so much that the fire department disallowed folks from going.
Yeah, this was in Prospect Park, Brooklyn.
And we were all there and we had all this food and there were no customers and we just got drunk. And you were dancing. I mean, Dale, everybody was it was like a
was it good
drunken,
or was it like drunk dance? It was bad,
I mean,
right?
I certainly
bad.
Like Elaine from
It was
Seinfeld.
A drunken dance fest with all this like amazing gourmet food. And there was, I mean, there was 10,000 portions for 300 people. And we had so much fun. And then the depression and that followed based on the fact that we all lost our shirts. I mean, people closed their restaurants because
of that. Really?
It was a bad...
Oh my God. She's like, I don't remember.
Force of nature. It was a force of nature. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about this queen of Southeast Asian cuisine.
Here's How great is that?
Here's what I want to know, because I know you so well, and I know that you still struggle with getting people to realize that you are of Filipino descent,
yeah.
That you cook this kind of food well. You're an expert in this food. Like, how, aside from having multiple restaurants, can you get that across?
I'd probably have to have like plastic surgery for people to actually believe. Actually, you know what I need? I need my mom to stand next to me because
yes.
I'm literally like the white version of her. My mom is Filipino.
She's beautiful.
Beautiful, like looks Asian. And I look like the white version of her. And anytime I'm not next to her, people are like, oh, what are you? Like, people think maybe I'm Italian or maybe I'm like Spanish or something
right.
like that, or Jewish. But no one ever thinks I'm Asian. And then if I stand next to my mom, they're like, I get it. I see it.
Right.
But so, what I don't understand what the, like, just, sorry. I make Italian food. I'm not Italian. Like, what's the issue?
The issue is, I think when someone wants a chef that cooks Asian food, they expect them
you go to
a
sushi restaurant and there's a white guy there and you're like, who's this white guy
yeah.
on my sushi counter?
Correct.
Fair enough.
And so for me to be an authority on Southeast Asian cuisine, especially Filipino food, if let's say I go on a morning show, they aren't expecting, it doesn't translate to the audience. They're like, why is she the one that's educating us on a different cuisine, because she doesn't look like she's from that country.
Judging a book by its cover.
Correct.
For
I've
sure.
I've got a friend who's an actress, and she's Latina, and she has like a white sounding name, and she literally had to change her name because she wasn't getting booked because they were like, you're not Latina enough.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm not Latina enough.
I'm
like,
not Asian enough.
Like, you know.
Yeah.
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 It's amazing. You're
not
Asian enough to make Filipino food, but it tastes so good.
Thank you.
That's the thing. So if anybody ever goes into the restaurants, they know you're legit. Your food is incredible.
But you know, I've had so many Filipinos come to the restaurant and they didn't know who I was, but they were like, oh, I heard the chef is Filipino. Is the chef here today? And I'm like, yeah, I'm the chef.
Do you speak any Tagalog? That's what you got.
Just the curse words.
Oh, there you go. Well, that's all you need in that scenario. Makalak. Can you give us a little something?
No.
Oh my God. So how do we, okay, so on our, you know, viral podcast that we're on right now,
yes.
How do we let everybody know that they should come to your restaurants and eat this kind of food? I mean, I don't know where else to get this kind of food. I always go to your places to
yeah.
get that kind of food.
I think actually there are a lot of more Southeast Asian restaurants. When I opened Pig and Cow 12 years ago, I can't believe it's been like 12 years ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We're actually re-signing the lease.
Yay. I'm so happy.
Yeah. I guess. Like, I don't know. Lower East Side is like a little weird now, especially on that side. So we're only signing a 3-year lease because.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because I don't want to commit for 10 years in that location. I just don't know. It kind of took a turn for the worse after COVID, which is weird because it was starting to change.
Yeah.
And then after COVID, it kind of
went a little
downhill.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean,
it's going to come back.
I think it's going to come back. And that's why we're only doing 3 years. But our landlord, like, there's no one else who wants to come in that space. So,
yeah. But you're still getting people to come down there. I mean, people are eating there.
Yes. I mean, so we're not as busy, but we are definitely busy. And I will say one of the things that's hard about a restaurant that's 12 years old is just how do you keep that buzz mm-hmm. going? How do you keep people still interested in doing what you do? And I think because we are unique, yes, more people people do that kind of cuisine where it's Southeast Asian under one roof, not like specifically Thai or Filipino. I think that helps us and has helped us stay in business. And we also try to be just super consistent.
I also think lesson learned from lockdown is people didn't understand that if they didn't support the restaurant that was their local favorite, it would go away.
Yeah.
And I don't think people realize that something's gone until it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, and you're consistent, and I feel like people will expect you to be there always.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. You're an establishment in that neighborhood. And then, of course, you open Piggyback in a very different neighborhood.
Completely different, kind of in your hood.
Yeah, and you know how I feel about my neighborhood. So my neighborhood is technically Murray Hill in Manhattan. Very close to Empire State Building, Herald Square, K-Town. I won't give away my address.
Murray Hill is where if you're young and Jewish and you come to New York City, that's where you first live.
Right. So I'm on the west side of Murray Hill. So I'm probably a little closer to Koreatown.
Yeah.
And then where you are is a little west of that, closer to Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
Actually.
Ooh. Yeah.
So
you haven't been there? No.
I've never been to Piggyback.
Yeah. Okay. I think we opened after you moved to LA. So.
Yeah, I got out of Dodge.
You gotta come.
Not only is the food amazing, the drinks are great, and then you have a fantastic event space in the back, which I've done a fundraiser in, and I've attended parties there.
Amanda won a golden uterus.
I did.
Really?
I won the golden uterus. That's at that.
I said it was rigged only fundraiser. Because I'm a sore loser.
It was a fundraiser.
Well, I'm sorry. Sorry. Can you? I need to hear more about this.
Fundraiser
uteruses.
It was a female chef and female mixologist got together. Fundraiser for the Marigold Project. Fundraiser for female reproductive rights.
Gotcha.
So I won the golden uterus. Although we all.
We all won.
I think your uterus is golden.
I mean, yeah.
It made two beautiful boys.
It did.
It really did. Okay.
I'm just going to.
You and
quiet.
Your non-uterine.
Non-uterine over there.
I'm just going to quiet it up.
Okay. So we're talking about Piggyback.
Yeah.
And that is in a neighborhood that's a little different than the
easier,
Lower East Side.
More accessible. There are tourists that are coming.
It's weird as shit.
It is.
It's super weird. So. When we first we opened in January of 2020. So we were
perfect
open.
Timing.
Yeah, it was so great. I was like, this is awesome. and we opened and we were so busy, like to the point where I was like, we're never going to catch up. You know, that feeling?
Yes.
And then we got up real quick because COVID basically made everything slow down.
It was illegal to go to your restaurant. How spectacular is that?
Yeah, and we were serving Asian food, so you automatically were getting COVID.
Well, it's either that and the 5G. Between that and the 5G, you're just shotsky.
Yes. And we closed the restaurant for like 14 months because it's in a neighborhood where it's all offices. And Madison Square Garden drives the business. And no one was doing sporting events, anything.
Concerts, anything
like that. And it took a really long time for it to come back. It's definitely back. And now we actually can, like, do events. And we book a ton of events, which is great.
Same food as Pig and Cow? Or?
It's a little bit different. So this is more like... We call it Asian, I don't know, Pan-Asian. So basically,
Pasian.
Like, Pasian.
You're in your force.
I throw in a little, like, food from, like, China, Korea, Japan, like, all these places I visited but, like, never felt like had a home because Pig and Cow is specifically Southeast Asian. Mm-hmm. So all my traveling to that part of the world.
Sorry, I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. What is Southeast Asian? We'll define the...
Southeast Asia is, like... Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, Philippines, Indonesia, that part. And then,
interesting. So then now you've expanded to like China, Japan and...
Like, so I spent some time in like Hong Kong. Oh. I worked in restaurants in Hong Kong. So like some of the like the food that inspired me there, I brought to Piggyback.
Yeah.
And Korea and Japan.
I want to go all the way back to when we sort of worked in a sister restaurant group. But after that, you did... sort of check out and go to Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
For how long?
A little bit over a year.
That's a big deal.
Yeah. I was working in an Italian restaurant. We had the same owner, sister restaurants. That's how Amanda
Which restaurant?
I was working at Gusto in the West Village.
And I was at Centro Vinoteca. I was Amber L's sous chef. And then I actually took over when she left the restaurant. And I was the chef there.
What a, like, an incredible, like, incestuous little group of talented people all in one little place, huh?
Yeah.
Yes.
Sasha was, I loved him when, you know, when it was good.
Sasha Munyak was the owner. He also owns Manja restaurants.
Can you say that with a little bit more?
Oh, Sasha Munyak.
Owns a Manja.
owns a Manja. I had a different relationship with the owners, but we can go back to that. But I want to know.
I really want to hear the dirt on this. Now I'm like, wait a second.
How you check out, you're in the middle of, you know, your New York career, Top Chef had aired, everybody's knowing your name, and then you check out for a year.
Yeah.
That's brave.
Yeah, I did it on purpose because I just really didn't like the attention because I got like torn up on like Eater and all the, like the articles like after Top Chef aired. And that was just like,
what do you mean
weird...
you got torn up?
Oh, like, well, first of all, I had like a showmance on, like, I like made out with some dude on the show.
I didn't know if you were going to want to talk
about
that.
Oh, I don't care about it. It was so long ago. And he had a girlfriend and I had a boyfriend who I wanted to break up with anyway before I went on the show, but I didn't. And whatever.
I mean, I guess I didn't watch the show. I feel so bad now because I would have known.
My husband has never seen the show and it's great.
Really?
Yeah, no, he doesn't watch that. He doesn't like that kind of stuff.
He doesn't like watching his wife and baby mama make out. It's so weird.
Yeah, that would be weird. So anyway, like, I think I did okay. I was like young. I was 26. I was like one of the youngest contestants. I had never cooked my own food. I had no culinary voice. I didn't know who I was as a chef. And I made it to the top five, but then they brought me back. And then I got eliminated. So now I'm like number seven ranking, which I think is kind of bullshit.
Wait, I was in the top five. You're number seven ranking all-time chefs on...
No, just for that season.
Oh, like, holy moly. You're extra...
Then I'd be like... Your number.
Well, but you got press in a way that you didn't want to get press, right? For having a romance on television. And they really exploited you.
Yeah.
Because you're a woman.
And because it was Bravo and because it's a new show and because, I mean, it's juicy, right? Like, you don't expect to watch a culinary competition and see, like, people making out, which really you should be because that's what we all do. We get drunk and then we make out with each other at the end of the night.
No. Speak for yourself. Dan and I have never done that.
Bullshit.
Especially not with each other.
Well, not
that's
us
That's actually
three,
not true. We've never had any. No, there's been no.
And I
want
that
to be no. My wife is going to watch this. My wife would not be happy with
but
that.
But I've had makeout sessions with people from your season.
Yes, I know. I've seen it firsthand.
Oh my God. So embarrassing. Okay, so then I'm really, truly, I mean this. That's brave of you to say, I'm out.
Yeah, I'm out.
That was a big decision.
I'm going to pack a bag and move to Asia. I had one thing set up in Hong Kong. With this guy, he was like the demon chef. I found out about him through No Reservation, through Anthony Bourdain's show.
Oh, wow.
And I said, I just thought he was like the coolest guy, and he really was. He was called the demon chef, and he had this like private kitchen in his apartment, and then he actually had like a big brick and mortar, and like I said to myself, one of these days I'm going to go stage there. I'm going to work there. And I actually did, which I thought was pretty cool, because most people say they're going to do something, and then, you know, moving to Hong Kong is... not
big deal.
It's not an easy thing.
How did your parents feel about that?
They were like, go. They were so supportive.
Are they still around your parents?
My mom is.
Your mom.
Yeah, yeah. And
that's a big deal.
Yeah, they supported me financially. Obviously, I was making like no money. And I was able to travel all around Southeast Asia for a year. By myself.
Wow.
Yeah. What about like the language barrier?
Language of food, man.
the cucina somewhere.
Yeah.
Fantastic. That is fantastic.
But a lot of people speak English.
I mean, Hong Kong, it's like...
Yeah, but I did like Thailand, Vietnam, the Philippines, Singapore, Malaysia.
Was the cuisine there like... I feel like the stuff that we are introduced to here in America is always, you know, a kind of like to our palate, you know, version of whatever the food stuffs are, that people are eating around the world. Were you confronted with food that was really... kind of
gnarly,
gnarly or anything that you wouldn't have normally?
I think because I grew up going to the Philippines, like I've been going there since I was four, and we would always stop in like a different country because it's such a long plane ride. I think I was training my palate at the time, but didn't know it from like a very young age, which is probably why I understand the flavors so well. So nothing was like that funky to me or that weird, but it was really great to try the ingredients from the soil, from the country of where it came from. You know, here, like the lemongrass sucks. The galangal is not good. Like California, you get much better produce, right? I always say like, if we could open a pig and cow in California, it would be so much better just
I mean, look at
based
the slanted
of,
door.
Yeah.
The slanted door is spectacular because he just said, I'm going to cook my food, but with this incredible array. So
you didn't eat anything that, okay, somebody who's listening, who's not a chef, who didn't grow up in a family like yours.
Yeah.
You came across a bowl of intestines and you just slurped that up. I mean, is that kind of thing?
No. I mean, I've tried the balut, the embryo.
Okay.
The half, whatever.
What's that, egg?
The egg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, whatever.
I'm not that into it.
So
I'll
for
try.
Those of you who don't know what it is, you crack open an egg and it is almost a fully formed.
There are no feathers, but it's
chicken.
Got a beak.
Sometimes there are. There's like a little, sometimes you can get like a beak, but it's not like hard. I mean, but for
it's
me.
It's not great sunny side up.
No. No. Typically no.
But like shrimp paste I love all of that
funkiness.
Stuff. All that funky, like.
Are there any like, I know that you love all the food from all the countries and like. I'm obsessed with like the colonial influence from different countries and how that, you know, how cuisine comes to evolve. Are there any countries that you really love the food more than others or like?
Yeah, Thailand. It's my favorite.
Thailand.
And I hate saying it because I'm like Filipino, but I love Thai food is my favorite food.
Really?
Yeah.
You've been to the night market in Taiwan?
Yeah.
I've never been there. Taiwan is
amazing. Amazing.
That's really high on my book. So talk about Thai food. What is it about Thailand?
I think what I love about Thai food is it's just so bold and it just like punches you in the face but it's still balanced. So it's a lot of acid, a lot of vegetables, a lot of heat, a lot of herbs, a lot of funk, and it's delicious. And it's so unique, like, I don't know,
I'm a lover of Thai food myself. Many years ago when it was probably my first line cook job in New York, I worked for John George Von Gerichten when he had Vong, which was a Thai
Vong.
French restaurant. So it was a combination of Thai and
in the
French.
Lipstick building.
Yes, it was, I had one of the best experiences there and I was still really learning, you know, balancing flavors and to learn how to use fish sauce and chilies and curry paste and shrimp paste and vinegars and sugar and palm sugar and all of those things to balance flavors is, I feel like every chef should go through that sort of palate training.
Yeah.
It's heat, it's herbal, it's everything without using salt and pepper.
Yeah.
And it's a completely different
or
mouthfeel. Right. Or butter or olive oil even.
Yeah.
So it was, for me, a really cool training because I was obviously trained on French cuisine, which was the technique we were using. And then we're using all Thai ingredients and basing it on Thai dishes.
Yeah.
So it is that balance of flavor that not every chef trains on.
Yeah.
So you had that advantage.
And I think one of the interesting things also with Thai food is the actual dish doesn't have to be completely balanced, but whatever you pair it with, because it's all communal eating, right? It's like family style. So if something is like a very acidic dish, then you'll have something else that is like sweeter and like richer. And so those are all supposed to balance.
So as
too.
A plate, it all comes together.
Correct.
And that, I love that.
Yeah.
That's really very interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you got to order a lot and you got to go with a big group.
Yes. Or, I mean, not and just,
and
eat,
just eat
a ton
all.
Of food.
So I'm not going to let any cats out of the bag, but you probably have some new projects coming up in the future. Would you do Thai food? Would you go Thai forward?
Only Thai?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, you could call it Only Thai. And then you could make it like a black Thai affair as well. You got to dress up.
I'm pretty sure there's no Thai restaurants called that.
No, I don't think I would only do Thai food. Yeah. I think we're opening a Pig and Cow Upper West Side.
You heard it here first, people.
Which is very exciting. It's been almost 12 years.
Congratulations.
And
that's
we're having
a big deal.
Second one. Thank you.
Where is it going to be?
It's on Amsterdam between 80th and 81st.
So, which in the EJ's Luncheonette space?
No. It was.
So sorry.
It was Haru.
Too much.
Like Haru.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it's like across the street from Jake's Dilemma. Amazing. Everyone knows Jake's Dilemma. I think they got like wasted there at some point.
Yeah, who hasn't?
Yeah.
Even if you live in Ohio and you're listening.
Yeah, it's right there.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
That's fantastic.
But I am putting more Thai food on that menu.
Okay.
Especially because I just got back from Thailand and yeah.
And you're so inspired from that.
Yeah.
Were you in the city? Where were you in Thailand?
I was in Bangkok. Yeah, just in Bangkok. I was there for like 5 days. So my husband and I, we flew into Saigon and we were there for 3 days. We went to Bangkok for 4 days and then we went back to Saigon for like a day and a half and we were just doing sourcing for Upper West Side. So I got wow. like all these plates from Vietnam. We got tabletops, chairs, street carts, all lights like from Bangkok, like all this. I mean, the space is going to be dope. And my husband's very artistic and
yes.
like he's helping with the design. We have a designer, but it's like very much a collaboration of the two of them. And
so you shop around and you say, okay, I want this, this, and this. Pack it up and send it to New York City.
So no, we have a shipping container. We have a guy who is...
You got a guy.
We got a guy. I always got a guy somewhere. And it's funny because my partner's like, of course Ben has a guy in Thailand. I was like, no, I have the guy.
Thank you.
It's my guy. I have all the guys. I have the contacts. No, Ben has some contacts too. But one of my friends who owns a restaurant in Bangkok, he's been in business for like 20 years on like the 50 best list year after year. I met him when I... went abroad and I did a pop-up at his restaurant.
Oh, wow.
And we've remained friends ever since. So he put me in contact with his guy and he is coordinating the whole shipping container and all of that. So
that's exciting.
Our street cart is being manufactured as we speak and then everything should be ready and we'll get it in like 6 weeks. So
it's so well curated. Yeah. And honestly, you know, I come from the heyday of when restaurants were designed and famous designers like David Rockwell were listed on the PR sheet. When we would open the door, everybody would know who designed it. And I don't think people take that much care as much anymore to go curate the tabletops and seek it out themselves. I mean, what do you think it adds to the restaurant to do that?
I mean, I think, Ben is like, he had a vision. Ben is my husband.
Right.
He had a vision and he...
I think there's like psychiatrists for that.
He was seeing
tabletops in his sleep.
What but did he take?
You know, he sometimes he feels like he doesn't get recognition
yes.
and that he doesn't have a place because he's... You know, he's a partner, but he's not the chef and he's not the face of the restaurant. And so this is really his time to shine for his creativity to come out. And he wants a cool space. Like the aesthetic is really important to him. And when we opened Pig and Cow so many years ago, we didn't have money and we were on a shoestring budget. And we weren't even together. So
right.
he like kind of half did it after, you know, he added some like elements, but after we were open, but this is like his thing and he did Piggyback too. So, cool. Yeah.
I didn't know that was something he enjoyed.
He loves it.
Cause it's hard to figure out what Ben likes.
I don't, you guys, I mean, you're married to him. So obviously you love the guy, but I thought he was like he's like a fun loving, wonderful, charismatic, you know, he's a front of the house guy.
He was a cook.
But he's a front of the house guy.
Yeah, but he doesn't work like as a front of the house manager day to day. So, you know, he's.
But I always felt like he was a gracious host. Like you go to the restaurant.
He's great. Yeah.
No, he is.
He is great. Amazing. And he really knows how to like.
Enough Ben bashing people. I got your back.
I would never.
Amanda loves him.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
We talk aside. We talk outside of Leah.
Yeah. So they have their own relationship.
We have our own relationship. Yeah. And we got to have some travels together. Certainly not Southeast Asia. We went to Israel together.
Oh, wow.
Which was a fantastic chef trip organized by Herb Karlitz, who is...
Karlitz & Co.
Yeah. A mensch.
Sponsored by
Karlitz. A mensch of a guy who basically called it celebrity chef's birthright.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
And it was quite an array of people.
Yeah.
I mean, so we had this incredible trip there, and that's a whole other side of your heritage.
Yeah.
You know, the Jewish cuisine. How do you ever incorporate that? Like, do you have a desire to incorporate that?
She's like, I've got latkes on the menu.
So that trip was the first time I'd ever been to Israel, which is crazy because I grew up, you know, Jewish, and I got bat mitzvahed, and I should have done birthright. I don't know why I never did. And I actually was pregnant on that trip, and I didn't know it. And I had a feeling, but I was like, nah, I'm just going to keep drinking and smoking my cigarettes until I get home and take a pregnancy test. And wow. Then, yeah, I know, right? Yeah. I'm very responsible.
If you're wondering what happened.
Oh, we shared a wall of the hotel, by the way.
We did. But, and actually, the reason why I knew I was pregnant was because we went to the Shuk, and I got all these spices, and they were just in the hotel room, and it was, like, making me nauseous.
I remember.
And I was just like, yeah, something's not right, but let's just forget about that for now. You know, I think it's really hard, like, blending the two cultures together from, like, a food perspective.
Of course.
There's a lot of ingredients that don't cross over. And one of the funniest things I remember when we first opened Pig & Cow was, like, some random weird guy calls the restaurant and goes, is the owner there? And I'm like, it's a Jewish guy. And I'm like, yeah, this is she. And he's
we could
like,
tell by the voice.
Yeah, he's like, I just want to know, what's a nice Jewish girl like you cooking pig? And I was like, what? I was like, that is weird.
But never on Saturday, though.
Yeah, never on Saturday. And so for me, it was just like, it was one of those things where I just never really kind of fused
Combine the two.
But you grew up eating Jewish food?
Yeah, and I'm obsessed with, like, Israeli Middle Eastern cuisine. Mm-hmm. I actually cook a lot of it at home.
That's what I was going to ask you.
And I, you know, Adina Sussman's cookbook is one of my favorites.
Shabbat, the new one, is phenomenal.
I have that one,
too. She's got, like, 9 different kugel recipes.
Yeah.
Shout out to Adina Sussman.
I mean, and she was on that trip, too. She showed us around. She took us to the market, to the Shuk. I mean, her pita recipe I make all the time. And I'm like, Ben will be like, oh, yeah, what are you making for dinner? I'm like, oh, I'm just throwing some pita together. He's like, what? I'm like, yeah, why not? Like, it's not that big of a deal. He's like, okay. But, yeah, like, so I love cooking that kind of cuisine, but it just doesn't find its way on my menus. Mm. Yeah.
I could see you guys opening, like, a traditional New York Jewish deli. Like, you and Ben.
In the Philippines.
Okay, great.
So my dad used to smuggle in Katz's pastrami and like it pack it in his suitcase, like 2 or 3 maybe, and also Russ and daughter's smoked salmon, and he would just like bring ice packs and whatever and put it in his suitcase, and he would give it to the senators. There was this that he was friends with. He was friends with a senator in Relay, and he had dinner with Imelda Marcos one time because they connected him.
Wow.
And yeah, and he would literally bring Katz's pastrami and Russ and daughter's smoked salmon to the Philippines.
That's culinary diplomacy right there.
Yeah. Send a salami to your boy in the army. We'll bring it with you.
Yeah, but that is something that they definitely would like. They need in the Philippines. Like, you can't get good pastrami.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the chef. There's a chef in Los Angeles who's married to a Filipino woman, and they're co-chefs together. And he has a restaurant in the Philippines and does very well for him there.
Oh.
Famous. It's got BC
Klet. The bakery. Not a bakery, but what is?
He's got BC Klet, and he's got Mansky, and his name is Walter Mansky.
Okay.
And I forget his wife's name, but they've got a restaurant in the Philippines. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Interesting. So you have a lot. Okay. So you're in New York City. Mm-hmm. You're going to now have 3 businesses in New York City.
Yes.
I don't have to ask this for me, but I'm going to ask you, for the listener, why New York City? Why?
I mean, number one, I grew up in New York. And honestly, I feel like New York is one of the hardest cities to own a business. And if you can make it.
You can make it here, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen.
Make it anywhere.
I think it's really, you know, sometimes I get upset because, like, I've never been really nominated for any awards, or, you know, I don't get recognized as much as, like, some other chefs. But for me, the satisfaction of having a restaurant in New York City that has been open for 12 years is, you know, is good enough for me. And
most people can't say that they have that.
I wonder why that is, because Pig & Cow is a phenomenal restaurant. I mean, it's like not just like a good restaurant. It's a really great restaurant, and it's been there. It's been and you've broken ground.
Yeah,
you'd have to dig into the politics of
that.
You think so? You think it's because of the Asian cuisine?
I also don't play the game. I also just don't play the game. I don't kiss people's asses.
Shaking her head over here. Is it a woman thing? Is it a cuisine thing?
We have a PR person in the green room. We can talk to Jesse, our producer, after to pick his brain about it.
I don't know. I don't know these things. I'm like a white guy.
I mean, I think that there's always like media darlings, right? And there are people who, but I've actually noticed that these media darlings that like kind of just like blow up, they sizzle out pretty fast too, and the restaurants don't stay open. So it's like, which would I rather have, like great press for a couple of years or a restaurant that's, you know, made it through Hurricane Sandy and COVID and is actually doing well and makes money?
Teach a horse to fish and he'll drink for his life.
Is that the saying? I'm really bad at saying, so I don't know if that's
definitely not it.
Sounds good to me.
But I think as we grow and mature, and I'll speak for myself, is like we leave a little bit of that ego behind of wanting those accolades and being okay with just being successful business person.
Yeah.
You know, and which you are in so many ways. I mean, you have multiple restaurants, you have a cookbook, you have a presence on television. Multiple shows that you've appeared
famous
in
girl.
And been on.
No.
And, okay, everybody, you're a mom of two very strong personality-driven boys.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
And I feel like I, you know, some people, it's like some working moms, like, they don't really get to spend, like, a lot of time with their kids. I can honestly say that I spend... Like, I'm very involved in their lives, which I think is good because I have the ability, because I don't have to be in the restaurant every single day, I can, you know, I have a flexible schedule and I can, you know, like, today I'm not going to spend that much time with them, but, like, tomorrow I'm with them all day.
Because you can control your schedule.
Yeah, yeah. So, and it's really important to me because they're young now and it, like... I had a great relationship with my parents, especially my dad, and I just want to be with my kids as much as I can till they don't want to be with me anymore. Right. And like right now, they're mama's boys. I don't know if you're a mama's boy, but like...
I mean, if you're not a mama's boy, you're a kind of piece of garbage.
Right, exactly. I mean, and Ben's like a mama's boy, and like my boys love me, and I love it, and they just want to be with me all the time. And so I feel very fortunate with my schedule that I can just be with them as much as possible.
Are you feeding them pan-seed at home, or what are they...
No, you know what? They are so picky. It is so frustrating. Like they hit two and then they want like dino nuggets and like,
by the way, you hit 40 and you want dino nuggets.
I am 40 and I don't want dino nuggets.
Sound amazing.
So I can see maybe the boys following in your footsteps. How would you feel about that? Do you want that to happen? Would you nurture that? Do you want them to stay absolutely out of the restaurant business?
Well, I named one of my sons Baker, so I feel like that's the obvious choice to
Destiny.
Go in there. So it's going to be Carter. but, I mean, yeah, as long as they know that it's hard work and they're going to miss out on like a lot of holidays and hanging out with their friends and, you know.
Started this thing going like, oh, the restaurant business. It's just like you get punched in the face over and over and over again.
It's one of those things that you just have to truly love. And as much as, like, I say I hate it, I can't imagine doing something else. It's just like...
You'd have to get a job.
I'd have to get a real job.
I'd have to get a job. What would I do?
Yeah, I mean, it's just frustrating at times, and it's always changing, but so is everything. And it's like you just have to adapt. And I think COVID really just kind of got everyone super defeated and really reevaluating whether or not this is what they want to do for the rest of
it. It was an opportunity to definitely stop and say, hey, we have an excuse to bow out gracefully.
Yeah.
And if we're going to keep on going, it better be intentional.
Yeah.
Because the first time around, you know, we've got all these aspirations. And then once you've done it and you know what it's like and you do it again, it's nobody's fault but your own.
Exactly.
No one pulled the wool over your eyes. That was it.
Yeah, for sure.
I just, you know, what do you think? I think about this a lot. What would you be or do if you weren't a chef? Because I can't imagine what I would do. Is there anything?
So excited to be a plumber.
I mean, like,
I'd have the great, I smell good plumbing company, Leaky Faucets. I've been thinking about this for years.
The only thing hardest I to get a good plumber about was it's being true. A refrigerator repairman.
Oh my God.
After I started to learn how to fix them myself in restaurants.
You'd be a pretty refrigerator repairman.
You get hit on all the time.
It would be exciting.
I don't know. I really don't know what I would.
That was this is your passion. You're sticking with it. You love it.
I do.
That's the only thing you would ever do.
I love it also because I don't have to be in the restaurant every day. Which, when I open Upper West Side, I'll have to be there a lot. So, but
it's so funny putting on my apron and getting into the restaurant is the hardest thing that I can do. And then once I'm there, I never want to leave. And love it so much. But for some reason, it's like I've got such a resistance to just tying my apron and like putting, you know, because I know that once you're in,
you're there.
That's it. You're gonna smell like the restaurant, the whole thing. Yeah.
I miss putting on a uniform. Honestly, I used to love that. I don't love. I'm so old school now that it's just an apron. That we as chefs, when we appear on television, we're wearing street clothes. You know, I loved the classic chef uniform. I loved putting it on. It got me in a mindset, and I loved wearing it all day. It was like I was in my pajamas.
You were wearing a double-breasted chef coat.
Yep.
Wow. And did you have your name on
pants.
It?
When I got up and...
When I got to be the boss.
When I climbed the ladder, it did. But, you know, we do stuff on TV, right? We've all done television. Yeah. How do you feel about the television aspect of your career? I know you have some love-hate relationships with it. You just recently were on Great American Recipe, which was on PBS. Mm-hmm. You've done a lot of competition on Food Network. You started out your television career on Top Chef.
Yeah.
Where do you see it all going now? What do you like about it?
I mean, honestly, I wish I was doing more TV. I think we would both say that.
Yeah.
I mean, you do.
And you tell me why, because I have a perspective about why I like it.
Well, you do way more TV than I do. But
it's not a competition, Leah.
No, it's not. But I would say for me, I think, you know, it helps. Number one, it helps the restaurants, right? Like the more people who know you want to come to your restaurant, and it helps business. It also helps with other opportunities like opening other restaurants or other businesses or having your own cocktail line or, you know, getting a second cookbook or anything, because right now as a chef, you have all this opportunity to make money outside of having a restaurant and just being a chef, right? Mm. And so I think that just having that notoriety on TV opens a lot more doors for you.
Right.
However, social media also does the same thing, which is why I've been trying to lean in more into social media.
I love your cooking videos.
Thank you.
And by the way, I cook from those cooking videos. So it's not like you're just a pretty face. Thank you.
Well, that's the thing that kind of upsets me is like there are a lot of content creators. I'm not going to call them influencers anymore because they don't like that.
Content creators
who make food and the recipes don't work.
Yeah.
And so that's really frustrating as like, you know, a trained chef.
It's more frustrating when you're the poor sucker that actually got through the whole recipe and then blames themselves because their food didn't turn out. It's like, actually that recipe sucked.
Yeah, that recipe wasn't good. And there are some people who I've made their recipes and they have like, you know, almost a million followers. And I'm like, oh, there has to be a reason why all of these people follow them. And then I make the recipe. I'm like, that did not work. And so that's what frustrates me about social media. But I think there is a great way, like maybe a balance between the two, or if, you know, Food Network or some other network doesn't want you on their on TV, you can go the YouTube route. And so I think there's just so much opportunity. But I think, you know, you need like 9 side hustles nowadays.
The number one rated show, most watched show last year was a YouTube show.
Yeah.
I believe that.
Yeah.
I mean, the next generation is not even using television.
I canceled my cable.
Yeah.
I canceled my cable.
Sorry, Verizon. You're charging me too much money.
But
I traded it for 45 different subscriptions where I can't find it. It just cost me more.
Yeah. You've cooked on television. You've judged.
Yeah.
You've hosted.
Yeah.
Which one would you like to do again?
I mean, I would say the competition is definitely not my speed.
Okay.
I don't think – it took me a really long time to accept that not being great as a – on-camera cooking competitor meant that I was, like, any less of a chef. Like, yes. I always thought that I was, like, not as talented as other people because I was not, like, great on cooking competitions. And it's a very specific...
I mean, were you just on Beat Bobby Flay? Like, that guy's...
I was judging.
Oh, yeah, I'm just saying, like, he's... There are certain people
Unchopped, I try to make it a point to always say to the chefs and on camera in front of them, we know this doesn't represent what you do in your restaurants. We know this doesn't represent you as a chef. A 20-minute time limit with a mystery basket and the pressure
yeah.
of making entertaining television,
yeah.
you know, is not natural yeah. for a chef. I mean, typically we're spending hours raising dough, you know, like
it's its own specific skill that some people are predisposed to.
Yeah.
But a lot of people like work their ass off to get there. They study for it.
It has nothing to yeah. do with whether you're a good chef or not.
Exactly.
I mean, I think we should just blanket statement that so that everybody can hear that. Every listener can hear that. And I don't think anybody goes to anybody else's restaurant because they're a good competitor or a bad competitor. You know what I'm saying?
No, but I think like mentally it gets in your head
of
when
course.
You like just keep losing of and you're like
Ferrari yeah. wins the race, they sell cars on Monday. That's like the way it works, right?
Yeah.
So
well,
I mean, I've lost every competition I've ever been in. So I'm like, I know yeah. this. I won't compete anymore because I'm like, I like to cook very slowly and
but
methodically.
But I still, yes. I'm the same way and I like to do a ton of research of like just I just take my time normally. Yes. I was in resource room growing up. So I had untimed testing for the SATs. So clearly I'm a little slower than some, but like I do like to take my time. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons why I'm not good at cooking competitions or not as good. I also have a confidence issue, which I think I get in my own head about. Also, maybe if I did it a little bit more, maybe if they asked me to compete more, then I could get in a rhythm of doing
only
it.
If you enjoy
maybe
it.
Maybe it's just because you're so judgmental, you just make a great judge.
Only if you enjoy
I'm
it.
I'm very
too.
Judgmental of myself.
I mean, I think for you, for anybody listening, the biggest joy is eating your food. You know what I mean? Going into a restaurant yeah. and eating your food. I love seeing you on television. I love being there with you in the green room. And I love being on set with you or being somewhere else with you. But honestly, like, I think that is not the marker for how good or of a chef you are.
Yeah.
It really isn't. And
well,
look
I
at
mean,
you
the marker is 12 years, your restaurant's still
successful like restaurants, opening another one. Everybody should be so lucky to have one of your restaurants in their neighborhood in New York City and hopefully in other cities. Philadelphia,
yeah,
please.
I got a call on Friday about spaces. So,
Philly.
Yeah.
Big shout out to Philly. We're going to have to wrap it up pretty soon.
Oh,
so,
no,
Dan,
I've
you
got
have
a
one
question.
More question.
Yeah. Only one more question?
That's all you got.
I was going to ask
make
you if
work.
You ate that amazing crab omelet from that lady in Thailand.
J5?
Yeah.
I got to tell you, this is going to be an extremely controversial statement. And not that good.
Ooh, oh, my and God. With that, everybody, Leah.
The technique is amazing, but it needs like a sauce and not the sweet chili sauce that she serves with it. Yeah.
Woo, you heard it here first.
You heard it
sorry,
here last.
J5, I love you. There's on so much other good food on her menu.
And on the line. Thank you, Leah, for coming in.
Thank you for
we
having me.
We love you. On the Line was recorded in New York City at Dubway Studios. Thanks, Al. Our studio engineer and editor is Mark Frangelo.
Our theme song is an original composition generously donated and played by Chef John DeLucci.
Our producer is Cindy Augustine, and our co-producer and publicist is Jesse Gerstein.
That's all, folks. Thanks for listening.